I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, a long view of the universe and our eternal search for meaning. We'll spend this hour with theoretical physicist Brian Greene, whose new book considers how pockets of order, like stars, galaxies, planets, and people, can exist in concert with the second law of thermodynamics, which states that natural systems produce increasing amounts of disorder over time. We'll put human existence into the context of cosmic time and space and talk about how Greene came to see the relative insignificance of our entire civilization as a thing to celebrate rather than regret. Our conversation starts after a short break. Of time, we will all eventually be forgotten. In about 5 billion years, the sun will burn itself out and devour the earth in the process, if it's still there. Our entire existence, from the formation of the planet that sustains us to the first single-celled organisms to come to life through all of human history, will end, as it must, with our extinction. In the vast expanses of space and time, we are a momentary aberration in the inexorable move toward entropy. If that depresses you, I get it, but consider how astonishingly, but not quite impossibly, lucky we are to have existed at all. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Brian Greene is professor of physics and mathematics and director of Columbia University's Center for Theoretical Physics. His new book takes a very long look at the history of the universe, deep into the past and far into the future. He uses science to tell the story, but this story is also about culture, about consciousness, and about our drive to discover how it is we came to be here. The book is called Until the End of Time: Mind, Matter, and Our Search for Meaning in an Evolving Universe. Brian, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much.
So you write that you've always been interested in math and physics, but for a long time it didn't occur to you to wonder why. What is the answer to that?
Well, you're right. When I was a little kid, and I think many physicists probably tell similar stories, I was just captivated by math as a game. I just loved to solve problems. I loved that the symbols somehow always would come together if you manipulated them correctly to yield a result to whatever problem you were studying. But later on, when I began to see that math was more than that, it was a language for describing the external world. And once you have a true statement in mathematics, it's true forever. It'll never not be true. And that timeless quality of math and its insights into the nature of logic and the nature of things in an abstract realm called mathematics, well, it just struck me as a kind of lifeline to a permanence that you otherwise don't have when you look at the familiar things in the world around you.
So math sort of transcends the temporary nature of your existence or anyone's existence.
It does, although if you think hard about it, as I do in the book, and especially toward the end of the book, you face interesting questions that may sound like, you know, a Zen koan or something like that. But, you know, is a mathematical truth, is it still in existence in any meaningful sense if there's nobody there to think about it?
Is mathematical truth more profound than philosophical truth, more pure?
In a sense, it is, but many philosophers no doubt would jump at the opportunity to argue the other side of that. And so perhaps I should be a little bit more precise. What I mean is, when you are talking about the truths revealed through human contemplation using the traditional language of discourse, natural language, English, French, Greek, Latin, whatever, the sentences that we speak in those languages have a certain degree of interpretation necessary to make sense of them. Whereas the sentences that we articulate in the language of mathematics are precise, they are rigid in their meaning, they are not open to interpretation within the system in which those sentences are constructed. So in that sense, they have a more pristine, a more precise, and in that way, a more lasting quality.
So did humans invent math or did we discover math?
I don't know. It's a good question. And it's one that I struggle with and have continued to struggle with for decades. early on, as a perhaps more naive physicist who just enjoyed the challenge of using math to describe things in the world, things in cosmology. You know, I've studied things like how did the universe begin and how does it evolve and is there some unification that can be imposed on our understanding of physical law? And in that setting, when you're working with the equations, especially on a good day, it feels as though you're just kind of chipping away the obscuring layers and just revealing an equation that's out there in the world to be discovered. But then there are other days, and I don't mean to hang this totally on whether it's a good day or a bad day, but there are other days where it really feels more like what we do is we take in the world through our senses and we try to organize our perceptions. And mathematics is a language that we humans invented that's really good at encapsulating patterns. And those patterns are the ones that our senses reveal to us. So in that sense, math might be a human invention that just allows us to overlay coherence on experience.
In the same way that language is a human invention that allows us to overlay coherence on experience?
Exactly. And all math would then be is a slightly different language in that, as I was saying before, the sentences in mathematics cannot be parsed. They cannot be interpreted in multiple ways, whereas we're all too familiar that any English sentence, just to pick one natural language, can mean different things to different people, can be interpreted in many different ways. And that's the beauty, right? That's the beauty of English as a natural language. That's why we can write poetry in the language of a natural discourse. But poetry written in the language of mathematics has a different quality.
You mentioned you have studied the origins of the universe. Is it easier to sort of read the distant past of the universe than it is to project about what will happen in the distant future?
Well, you're more certain about the things you say about the distant past because as we use our equations to, in effect, turn the cosmic film in reverse. I mean, that's really what we do with our equations. We have enough understanding of the physical unfolding that we say to the math, hey, run that unfolding backwards. Mm. And then we look at the equations and they tell us what things were like in the distant past. And then the beauty is those sentences that tell us what things were like in the distant past also come with corollaries that tell us, okay, here's something that you might not have known about the universe today that distant environment will yield. Look for it. And then we obey the mathematics and we build devices, telescopes, particle accelerators, and we look for the implications. And if they're there, if we find them, if we confirm the predictions, we feel like, wow, okay, we really do understand what happened in the distant past. You can't really do that with the distant future. You can take the math and you can say, hey, fast forward the cosmic film. Show me what it's going to be like a billion or 100 billion years from now. And the math will do that for you, but you don't have any observations or tests that allow you to feel greater confidence beyond just this mathematical description. But since the math has worked so well for the past, it seems reasonable to imagine that it will also work well for the future.
How can you apply math when the universe is gaining entropy or growing in entropy all the time, according as it must to the second law of thermodynamics?
Well, the beauty of all of the laws of physics is that what they are economical ways of encapsulating rhythmic patterns that we see play out in the world. And when something follows a pattern, even if it's heading toward ever greater disorder, which is what the second law of thermodynamics says, the way the universe approaches ever greater disorder is according to a mathematical unfolding. So even though things are becoming more chaotic and structures are disintegrating and things are falling apart, they're not doing that in a haphazard way. They're doing it in a very organized, a very systematic way. And we have the mathematics that describes even that kind of degradation. So the fact that we're heading toward ever greater disorder in no way impedes our ability to use the equations to say things about the far future.
But if we're heading toward ever greater disorder, help me understand why there is a great deal of order in the observable universe. Why is it that we can have galaxies and stars and life?
Well, there are two parts to that answer. The first is, well, I should say at the outset, we're not completely sure of the answer to that question. So what I can give you is snippets of answers that we believe are part of whatever final answer science ultimately comes to. So one snippet is we believe that at the very early moments of the universe near the Big Bang, we believe there was a lot of order right there in the beginning. And in a sense, we have been living through the degradation of that initial order. If there wasn't any order at the beginning, then we would not have any order today. But the second part of the answer is a little bit more subtle in that even though the second law says that we are inexorably heading toward ever greater disorder, it only says that in an overall sense, the entirety of reality is getting ever more disordered. And that does not rule out the possibility that little pockets of order can form here and there and everywhere else, so long as in their formation, they necessarily give off enough waste, enough heat, enough disorder to the surrounding environment, so that overall the disorder goes up, but the little pockets can have increasing order. And that process is something I call the entropic two-step. It's kind of a dance, right? It's as if entropy is doing this dance where entropy grows over there, but it decreases over here. And that is the way in which stars and planets and ultimately people form. We are little pockets of order forming in a universe that, on aggregate, in an overall sense, is becoming more disordered.
If the universe has never been more ordered than it would have been in the sort of moments right after the Big Bang, what must that have looked like?
Well, we think that the early universe was very, very hot, but very, very smooth. It could have been riddled with little pockets of high density, little black holes, if you will. So the universe could have been sort of a bath of black holes early on, which would have been a highly disordered configuration. But all our observations and all our calculations suggest that it wasn't like that. Instead, it was anything but little dense balls bouncing around. It instead was a nice, uniform, smooth environment. And that is, we believe, the order that characterized the state of the early universe.
So there's a black hole at the center of every galaxy we know about, right?
Pretty much, yes.
So is that sort of cranking out disorder as the stars and planets that might surround that black hole in the center of the galaxy continue to exist?
Absolutely. So black holes are, as I think many people are familiar, regions of space that have a lot of mass, a lot of energy that's crushed into a relatively small size, yielding a powerful gravitational pull. But what people are less familiar with is what you just summarized. Black holes are also those regions of space that harbor the greatest amount of disorder, the greatest amount of entropy. So yes, the center of galaxies is a place. It's an entropic engine, if you will, in which other stars and planets can fall in, making the black hole bigger, increasing its entropy. And that kind of process is playing out right now in the heart of the Milky Way galaxy, in the heart of most every galaxy in the universe.
Will the black holes eventually win?
In the end, yes. So, in the very far future, the things that we are familiar with in the night sky, because we can see them, the stars and the galaxies, ultimately they will disintegrate. They will fall apart into their constituent particles. And that is a move from order toward disorder. And black holes can actually also do that. They can also fall apart, something that Stephen Hawking taught us about many decades ago. But the timescales for black holes to disintegrate is far, far larger than the timescales for stars. And therefore, black holes will hang around for a very long time.
My guest is Brian Greene, professor of physics and mathematics and director of Columbia University's Center for Theoretical Physics. His newest book is Until the End of Time: Mind, Matter, and Our Search for Meaning in an Evolving Universe. This is Think. I'm Chris. Chris Boyd speaking this hour with Brian Green, who's professor of physics and mathematics and director of Columbia University's Center for Theoretical Physics. His most recent book is Until the End of Time: Mind, Matter, and Our Search for Meaning in an Evolving Universe. What is the difference, Brian, between asking how we got here and why we are here?
Well, I think how is a mechanistic question, and it's the kind of question that science and physics in particular is pretty good at addressing. We want to know the steps, the physical processes that take a universe from the Big Bang and somehow allow structures like stars and planets to form. And somehow on one of those planets, molecules can collect together into amalgamations that at some point stand up and start to walk around and start to think about things. So we'd really love to know the detailed processes that allow that to happen. And we've done a pretty good job at that. But of course, that doesn't directly address the why question. And a why question is a question that science is not particularly well adapted to address. But my deep feeling is that by understanding the how questions, we frame the why questions in a different manner. And the why, therefore, can be informed by the how. And that's certainly the approach I take in the new book.
How much progress have we made toward understanding how life forms came into existence from materials that were not alive previously?
Well, I think we made a lot of progress. It's not the case that anybody can sit in a laboratory right now with a collection of chemicals, throw them together and zap it with, say, electricity, and it comes to life. No one's been able to create life from scratch in the laboratory. But I think most scientists agree that you don't need anything beyond ingredients, molecules, atoms, particles, and the laws of physics, which support the laws of chemistry, which support the processes of biology, that's all that you need. There was a time when people thought that you needed something else, a life force. You needed, vitalism to animate a collection of inanimate particles. And without that life force, there would be no such thing as life. By understanding now the detailed molecular processes that underlie the workings of cells, that underlie the workings of collections of cells and so forth, most scientists who think about it are pretty convinced that we don't need anything else but physics and particles to yield living systems.
So living things evolve, which is one reason that life requires death, I gather. Is there any evidence that non-living things evolve, that the universe somehow is evolving rather than simply changing?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, when we use the word evolve, I think many of us learned it in the context of Darwinian evolution. We learned about it in the manner that Darwin and Russell Wallace, I mean, there were people who thought about this in the 1800s in response to the question of how do we get the wealth of species on planet Earth? And in that setting, we all know the answer. The idea of descent with modification, namely progeny, do not look and have exactly the same molecular makeup as their parents. And those changes that are good for survival tend to spread, and those that are not good for survival tend to die out. But the idea of evolution is much more general than that application to living systems, because even if you have inanimate particles, say, in the early environment of planet Earth, once a molecule learns the trick of making a copy of itself, it's an interesting trick, but it's not that hard for molecules to acquire this capacity to make copies of themselves, then you've got a version of evolution at the level of inanimate objects. Because when a molecule makes a copy of itself, if that copy is itself somewhat different from the parent molecule and is better able to make more copies of itself than its parent, then that mutated particle, that mutated molecule, will dominate the molecular demographics. You sort of have a chemical combat that happens in early Earth. You can sort of view it as molecular version of Darwinian evolution. So yes, things do change. And they do evolve under the same kind of selection pressures that we're familiar with for living systems, but they don't need to be alive for these notions of evolution through selective change to take place.
All right, I want to go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak with Paul in Garland, Texas. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Hey, y'all. My question is, considering the entities, considering the mathematics, the physics of our cosmos, are we, in our life form, the most involved entity that is known of in the cosmos?
Thanks for calling.
Well, it's very difficult to know what is the right way of measuring, of determining, or even precisely articulating which life form is more evolved compared to another. I mean, you can certainly look at the history of any given life form, and you can trace it back through earlier stages, and therefore you can say that this life form evolved from an earlier one. But if there are life forms that are so widely spaced in this evolutionary diagram, if you will, it's hard to really say which is more evolved than another. And that uncertainty is just at the level of planet Earth. I have no idea, and nobody really does have any idea, whether there is other life out there in the universe. I think many of us think it highly likely that there is, not in a scientific sense, just in sort of a gut check sense. It seems likely that we are not the only living systems. And there's nothing in our math, nothing in our physics, by any stretch of the imagination, that would suggest that we are the most evolved, whatever precise definition you put to that phrase. I can certainly well imagine that we will one day encounter extraterrestrial life that knows much more than we know, that it's been around many billions of years more than we have. So these qualities of evolution need not, in some sense, be special to planet Earth. They may happen widely throughout the universe, and we may just be one among many species that have evolved throughout the cosmos.
How does a physicist explain consciousness?
That's a big puzzle, consciousness. It's a mirror image, in some sense, of the puzzle you raised before about how can it be that inanimate matter, you put it together and somehow it lives, right? How does life emerge from things that are not alive? And I mentioned there that we don't fully know the answer to that, but there's every indication that it's just particles and physical law. I would say the same thing about consciousness. You have a similar puzzle. How can it be that particles that themselves don't have inner experience? Like, I don't think electrons have any sense of sadness or joy, right? But somehow when you put a lot of them together with other collections of particles inside a gloppy 3-pound gray structure that sits between our ears, somehow that collection of particles can experience love and joy and grief. And how in the world is that possible, right? That is the puzzle of consciousness. And this has led people to some very strange proposals, like maybe electrons do have some proto level of inner sensation. And only when you put a lot of them together does that proto version turn into the conscious version that you and I are both familiar with. But I don't think you need that. My suspicion, and it's only a suspicion at this stage of our understanding, is just like with life, you don't need anything more than particles in a highly organized, choreographed manner. When they move in the right way, they are carrying out a certain kind of information processing, and conscious inner awareness is the byproduct of those physical processes, and that's all there is to it.
Consciousness gives us the sense that we have free will. Is it possible that everything that happens, everything we think and do, is actually just governed first and foremost by the laws of physics?
Not only possible, I feel strongly that is the way the world works. I, like everybody else, have a sensation of freedom, a sensation of free will. I feel right now, as you and I are talking, I feel like I'm choosing my words, that I'm deciding what I am saying. And it feels like all of those decisions and choices are originating with me. But my deep understanding of physics suggests that that is not really the case. I am just a collection of particles governed by physical law, and the way those particles behave is fully governed by those physical laws. There's no place for me to intercede in that rigid cosmological unfolding of which my particles partake. And therefore, I would say that the sensation of free will that I feel, it's a real sensation. Of course, I feel it right now, as do you, as does anybody who's listening to us. But I think it's only that. I think it's just a sensation that overlays an unfolding that ultimately stands outside of our control.
Have we reached the point in the semester where students start coming into your office during office hours crying and saying they can't really handle this anymore?
Well, we no longer have live classes, right? So yeah. It's in a metaphorical sense. But certainly, yes, I have taught a course for a couple of years on my book, On Until the End of Time. And I have had students come into my office in an emotional state. And I thought it was utterly wonderful for that to be the impact of thinking about the world differently. And as I told these students, I said, look, it's great to have your world shake now and then. Hmm. It's good to shake things up. Now, you may, in the end of our discussions, come back to see the world exactly as you did before we had any of our discussions, but it's good to challenge things that seem manifest, that seem obvious, that may not be. And among them, chief among them, is this sense that we have free will.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You are not a religious person, Brian, but you seem to understand completely why many people embrace faith.
Yes, and I'd even say slightly differently, because I am not religious in any conventional sense. I don't go to services. I don't follow the detailed rituals of any established religion. But I do feel that I'm a spiritual person. I do feel that the work I do as a physicist informs me as a person, but does not define me as a person. When I look out at the world, I experience the wonder of it all. I experience the deep harmonies that are captured by the physical laws, and that fills me with a sense of awe and gratitude and wonder. And I consider that to be a spiritual perspective on the world. But when it comes to more formal religions, yes. I mean, there has been a lot of work done on trying to see whether religious belief might have an evolutionary value, right? There are researchers who suggest that in the ancient past, those hunter-gatherer groups that were bound by a common religious affiliation would have triumphed over other groups that were more loosely bound. You're more likely to be willing to sacrifice yourself for a member of your group if there's a deep religious affiliation, a deep religious bond between you. So that's one of the ideas that people have put forward for why religion may have naturally evolved as our species attempted to prevail in the ancestral world.
So humans over time have developed these broadly shared beliefs that there must be more to reality than what we can directly observe. This can lead us to faith, but what's so interesting to me is that it's also a major driver of science, right? This sense that there must be more to knowledge than what we have previously observed directly.
That's true, although the approaches that the two trajectories toward this deeper reality follow are rather distinct. When it comes to the scientific perspective, we only investigate potential qualities of the world that we have missed if they naturally emerge from our equations, if they're naturally suggested by theories that have themselves already been established through observation and experiment. And that's the way that we attempt to penetrate deeper into that obscured reality. If you approach the world from a more religious perspective, you tend to be less concerned with proof, less concerned with observations that will establish this or that hidden quality of the world. I mean, the very definition of faith is to take some quality of the world as true in the absence of some direct evidence for it. And as a scientist, I just feel far less convinced and I feel far less confident in qualities of the world if they don't have that evidence behind them. And that's why that's the approach that I follow. But yes, from 30,000 feet, we're all trying to dig deeper into the nature of reality.
People who have faith are sort of told to live with the mystery and accept what they can't understand. Do you see it, and maybe this is the wrong language to use, spiritual language, but do you see it as a blessing or a curse that we are driven to understand things scientifically that may be beyond our capacity to comprehend?
Well, I've yet to be convinced that there are such things that are beyond our ability to comprehend. And that may sound like hubris, but what I really mean by that is every challenge that we have set ourselves so far, we've been able to make progress on. You know, we've discovered all sorts of particles that are non-obvious, but they emerge from our math, and we found means of testing these ideas through experiments. We've been able to use math and observation to, as I mentioned before, turn that cosmic film back to a fraction of a second after the beginning, and then make predictions about, say, the temperature variations across the night sky that we can confirm to fantastic precision, which is all just to say, yes, we may encounter things in the future where no matter how hard we work, we're unable to make any progress. But so far, we've not hit the wall. So I like to think that the human mind is well positioned for understanding the deep mysteries of the world.
It's so hard for human brains to conceive the scales of cosmic time and space. How does seeing our existence in the context of those things affect our experience of being alive?
Well, it affects me. I can talk personally about that. I think different scientists will give a different answer. But when I first began to think deeply about the far future, I have to say it filled me with dread. But then as I understood things better, it actually filled me with gratitude. And I'm happy to fill in more details on that if that would be a useful direction to follow.
We'll definitely come back to that. My guest is Brian Green, professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University and author of Until the End of Time, Mind, Matter, and Our Search for Meaning in an Evolving Universe. We'll be right back. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Brian Green, who's professor of physics and mathematics and director of Columbia University's Center for Theoretical Physics. His most recent book is Until the End of Time, Mind, Matter, and Our Search for Meaning in an Evolving Universe. Before the break, Brian, you promised to tell us how you relieved your existential dread about, I guess, your relative insignificance in the universe, which is like the greatest clickbait line ever. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that's a good way of summarizing where I was when I first really began to think deeply about these things. I mean, how can you not feel tiny?
Yeah.
Not only in space. I think many of us are familiar with feeling small in space. If you've seen the famous pale blue dot image of planet Earth behind the rings of Saturn, you realize that little tiny dot is where everything that we care about takes place. So we are so small in the expanse of space. But it's also true that we are tiny in the expanse of time. As we understand the far future, we recognize that the far future will very likely be devoid of life. Life will not be able to exist in the universe in the very far future. So yeah, it all makes you feel quite insignificant. And what began to shift for me over time was a shift away from looking for value and meaning and significance through legacy, through something lasting. That's what we have always done, right? We build the pyramids out of stone so they will be a monument that lasts. We chisel our name in stone so it will last, right? That's the way in which we have often clung to some notion of value and meaning. And I just did a radical shift, one that I think is familiar to anybody who's spent time reading the great philosophers or listening to mindfulness teachers in the modern era. It's a shift away from grasping for a receding future to inhabiting in the deepest possible way this present that we have this wonderful access to. And it was that shift that really marked a substantial change in my own life. And it then made the future not seem so bleak to me. Rather, I saw myself as the product of these quantum laws that by chance allowed me to exist. And against astounding odds, I, as a collection of particles, am here. And that just filled me with deep gratitude. And beyond that, it's a gratitude that human particles, human collections of particles, can do things, right? We we can create beauty. Just think about what we've done, from Beethoven's Ninth Symphony to King Lear to the Mona Lisa. These are things that collections of particles have created. And we can experience wonder. We can illuminate mystery. And that's what science is about. And it just gave me a deep sense of gratitude for being here at all.
Art, I want to go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak first with Domi. Hi, Domi.
Hello. Thank you for getting my call.
Sure.
My late father was a physicist, too. And he developed a mathematical model for the origins of the solar system, where the sun would have had a sister star, twin star, and the planets would have been formed in special Lagrange gravitational points in between these two stars and his sister star. The sun's sister star is still traveling away from the sun, and his equations were able to actually pinpoint which star this would have been.
Have you heard that, Brian?
I've heard of various theories that have posited sort of a twin to the sun. I'm unfortunately not familiar with the caller's father's theory in any substantive way. But I would simply say that there are still mysteries about the details of how the solar system formed. We think we have a handle on it. We think that there was a big cloud of dust that swirled around, and through gravitational pull, a lot of that gas and dust came together in an ever larger blob that ultimately yielded the sun. And the leftover gas, we believe, coalesced into smaller structures, too small for nuclear processes to happen, and they are the planets. But it's certainly not the case that we can predict with fantastic precision every detail of that process. So there's still room for interesting ideas. And whether the caller's father's theory is relevant to that, I just really can't comment on. But I'm glad that people are inspired to think about these things.
Can I ask you a personal question?
Please.
So you're fortunate to be moving through the world with a pretty extraordinary brain. But someone who is sort of trying to understand the workings of the entire universe, past, present, and future, I mean, there's a limit to how much will fit in any human brain. So, I mean, how do you approach the fact that you can try and understand everything that every other brilliant person has posited and sort of take their ideas into account, but that you will never be able to absorb it all?
Yeah. Well, I think what it really means is you have to be incredibly selective in the features of the world that you try to gain an understanding of. I mean, in the most flat-footed way, I faced that challenge when I was writing this book and writing until the end of time. I'd tell people, they'd say, what are you writing? I'd say, well, the universe from beginning to end. They'd say, oh, really? And my goal was to keep it relatively short. And the way I made my choices was, there are things that are deeply interesting and meaningful to me. And those are the things that really speak to what it means to be a human being. And to me, the deep parts of being a human being, we are a deeply social species. We are a deeply creative species. We're an innovative species. We're a species that loves to unravel mysteries. So that led me to think about those qualities of the world that we can understand that led to the formation of stars and planets, led to the formation of people, led to our forming groups of individuals wandering along the African savannah, and how those groups began to innovate and create art, philosophy, and things of that sort. So there's a lot in that story that I leave out. There's nothing to do with politics. There's nothing to do with our governmental institutions. There's nothing to do with economics. These are all important things that I don't really know enough about, and they don't fire me up in the same way. And so basically you go where your passion takes you.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We have Lisa on the line in Boulder, Colorado. Hi, Lisa.
Hi there. I just wanted to say that I found what he said prior to the last caller just absolutely brought a huge smile to my face, and because it centers around exactly what I have a question about. You said that as a scientist, you value the ability to replicate and test and look at what is actually there. How do you replicate, for instance, your experience of wonder and beauty, and what is their evolutionary how did they come about evolutionarily?
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, so, I mean, the question speaks to the even broader notion of why human brains have the particular qualities, the particular experiences, the ability to take in the world and process it in certain ways and respond in the manner that we all are familiar with. And that's, these are deep questions that have yet to, in any sense, be fully unraveled. But I would suggest, if the reader wants to follow, if the questioner wants to follow up on this, things to read would be the whole literature of evolutionary psychology, somewhat controversial subject, but I find it a deeply satisfying way into thinking about what evolutionary pressures in the ancient world might have given rise to a brain that would respond in the ways that we humans do. For instance, can you find an evolutionary basis to the fact that we smile? So the caller said it brought a smile to her face. Darwin himself traced that physiological reaction to certain stimuli in the world. And you can go much deeper, and evolutionized psychologists have, to try to understand human emotion, human reaction, and the ways in which we have socialized with each other as coming out of the evolutionary pressures that we faced across 100,000 generations. I can't stress enough. We, as inhabitants of the civilized world, civilizations have been around for just a handful of thousands of years, whereas our species evolved over the course of, you know, a million, depends where you put the peg in the sand, but a million, 2 million years. So things that happened in the distant past affected 100,000 generations, not the 250 generations of modern civilization. And that's where our brains acquired the features that they currently do. So it's a fascinating subject, and one that I think that the caller would be interested to follow up on.
We have a tweet from Joanne who wants to know, is there any evidence that the universe has had multiple expansions and contractions?
That is a theory that people are now developing. It was out of favor in the 40s to roughly the year 2000. Nobody was really thinking about a cyclic universe, which might expand and contract and expand again. But a group of researchers have kind of resurrected this idea, and people are starting to take it seriously. So it's not mainstream yet. The mainstream theory still imagines that there was a single Big Bang, the universe swelled, and it's still swelling, it's still growing in size. In fact, at an accelerated rate, the universe is expanding. But there are people who are considering that cyclical possibility, and that may gain more traction over time.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. How did time start to exist?
I don't know. I feel like I've said that a lot in this interview, but that's a good thing, right? There's so many things you get to fully understand. One possibility is that time started at the Big Bang. So it may be that in the phase, an earlier phase, if you will, of the cosmos, there was even no notion of earlier. There was no notion of time. It may have simply been an arena in which the concepts in space and time don't apply. And then when the universe underwent this rapid swelling of space that we call the Big Bang, space and time may have emerged from that swelling. And therefore, their origin may have been within the Big Bang itself.
All right, I want to go back to the phones. We have Kay on the line in Fort Worth, Texas. Hi, Kay.
Hi. This is my question. I have read some literature that says artificial intelligence is the next jump in the human evolution.
Thanks for calling. What do you think about that, Brian?
I think there's a good chance that that summary may well be borne out in the future. There's nothing that says that the intelligence that resides inside a squishy gray thing that we all have on our shoulders is the best intelligence or the most potent or the intelligence that's best able to survive. We may create a certain kind of intelligence in an artificial manner inside of, say, a computer, and that intelligence may far outstrip our own, and that intelligence might well be the next step in the evolution of intelligence broadly defined.
When you say in the book that maybe due to the expansion of the universe, there will come a time when thought is no longer possible. What do you mean by that?
Well, thought is a physical process. Now, you can argue against that, but as I mentioned before, my view of consciousness is that it's just particles coursing through the brain governed by physical law. So thought is itself a physical process. And every physical process to bring this conversation full circle has to give off disorder, has to yield higher entropy. And in the far future, you can argue fairly convincingly that the universe will not be able to absorb that entropy. It'll be kind of stuffed full. And if the universe can't absorb the entropy, then when a thinking being tries to think, it will actually burn up in the entropic waste of its own thought process. It will die. And that will mark the end of thought.
We have an email from Tim who wants to know, could the laws of physics be different in different parts of the universe or in a different universe?
Absolutely. You know, we only have access to, we believe, a part of the universe, the so-called observable universe. We believe the universe extends beyond distances to which we do not have access simply because light from those regions hasn't had enough time to reach us. And so could it be that way out there, very far away, the laws of physics are different from the laws that we are familiar with? It's possible. There's no evidence for that. And in fact, everywhere we can look, the laws of physics appear to be the same. But in another universe that emerged maybe from a different Big Bang, could the laws be different in principle? The answer to that is certainly yes.
So all these kinds of thoughts give you extraordinary context for your own existence relative to the universe and the miracle of being around. But like your life is still your life, right? You still stub your toe and forget to pay the electric bill or whatever. I wonder how this kind of thinking, does it work for you in times like the one we're living through where people are very concerned about a pandemic and lots of people are afraid and disquieted?
Well, it absolutely does. You're right. I mean, after I get off this interview, I literally have to take the garbage out. That's not even a metaphorical version of that statement. But look, you know, when I look around the world and I see the tragedy that is befalling us right now, I do feel I can take it in two ways. I take it in as an ordinary citizen of the world, an ordinary human being who deeply feels that tragedy and feels the pain and sees the sorrow and all of that. And that's deeply disquieting and painful. At the same time, I can pull back and see a parallel story where these are the motions of particles on a collection of particles called planet Earth that's in orbit around a star called the Sun in the outskirts of an ordinary galaxy. And that cosmic perspective does, for me, give me a certain kind of solace that these are just the kinds of things that happen in a universe governed by physical law.
Brian Greene is director of Columbia University's Center for Theoretical Physics and author of Until the End of Time, Mind, Matter, and Our Search for Meaning in an Evolving Universe. Brian, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter, and you can subscribe to the Think Podcast free wherever you get your podcasts by searching for KERA Think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.